Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The stock market crash that unleashed the Great Depression happened on October 29th, 1929. 2 months later, America began a new year, 1930. What did that year hold? What decisions were made that left a lasting impact on the next 12 years? We're asking because right now, the U.S. is once again about 2 months into a triggering event, the COVID pandemic, and the shutdowns in response to it. So we want to look back at 1930 and ask, what lessons does that year hold for what might come for the remainder of 2020 and beyond? This hour on Point, what we can learn from 1930. And to help us with this, we're turning to David Kennedy. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2000 for his book, Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 to 1945. His most recent book, co-edited with Mark Brilliant, is World War II and the West It Wrought. He's Emeritus Professor of History at Stanford University. David Kennedy, welcome to the program. David Kennedy, are you there? All right. Well, we will try to get him on the line here. So fortunately, joining us now as well is Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, and he's with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hello, Megan.
Hi, Dave. Hi, Jack. So we will be getting David Kennedy on the line here in just a second or two. But first of all, the reason why we wanted to have this conversation today, or sort of my animating idea here, was that you and I have discussed before, Jack, the October 29 crash was the trigger, but perhaps not necessarily the cause of the Great Depression. And similarly, the COVID pandemic is the trigger, but there are underlying factors that give this current economic downturn its particular force and velocity. And I just want to know, if you think that that's actually even a valid comparison to begin with.
I think it's spot on, especially the latter point, because aren't we discovering in this crisis the structural weaknesses of the economy and how inequality is undermining prosperity and, of course, endangering health. We've seen how the lottery, the cruel lottery of this virus, has worked so hard against the poor and against people who have to work with their hands and serve the rest of us. And that has been true all along, and now we're seeing it crucially, how the, you know, decades of inequality, of stagnant wages, of thwarted hopes are now showing up in the mortality statistics of this epidemic. Mm.
And so we're hoping to take the measure of how the United States responded to that previous triggering event in that first year. Because I'm really trying to learn sort of what might we anticipate, if anything, in terms of the next 12 months, given what the nation has already gone through in 1930. So let's turn back to Stanford, California, and see if we have David Kennedy with us on the line. Professor Kennedy, are you there?
I am here.
Hello. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And once again, we're living in a new era of technical glitches just about every day. So I appreciate your patience, Professor. So first and foremost, we have the luxury of having historians like you and Jack to help us look back on the experience of the people who lived through the Great Depression. But put us in their shoes, in the president's shoes, in policymakers' shoes, in the year 1930. Was there a sense at that time that the economic shock that the nation was beginning to experience or had begun to experience, did they know it might last a long time? What was the original thinking?
Well, Meghna, you remind me of the old adage about how history is remembered backward, but it's lived forward. And the people living it can't see the future with any clarity. It's one of the great advantages of historical perspective is that we can see a bigger picture than people living through it could. But look, in 1930, nobody was yet calling it the capital G, capital D Great Depression. and Herbert Hoover, the president of the United States at the time, and many other people, as 1930 began to unfold, thought that they were living through just yet another of these periodic downturns in the business cycle. They'd occurred every 5 to 10 years back into the dawn of the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. It was thought to be just a way the business was conducted, that you had to suffer through one of these downswings every few years. And as it happened, the previous one of any consequence had been just after World War I, 1921-22, when Hoover had been Secretary of Commerce in the Harding administration. And on that occasion, he took the lead. Hoover took the lead as secretary in a number of what economists would call counter-cyclical initiatives, trying to accelerate public spending, urging employers to maintain wage rolls and payrolls and so on. And Hoover got credit at that time for the relatively brief duration of that earlier downswing or recession. So he thought, again, not without reason, that what was happening in 1930 was a replay of that, and he went to the same toolbox. But neither he nor anyone else could anticipate what the future held. And it became a crisis we now know it in history books as the Great Depression. At that time, a singularity. Still, in some ways, I think even when this one is over, the Great Depression is going to remain the biggest economic catastrophe of modern times. But nobody could see that coming clearly in 1930. Right.
That is absolutely fascinating, David Kennedy. They didn't, Hoover and other politicians or leaders didn't have a sense that it was different even after the incredible swan dive that the market took. I mean, that was a huge one that the market took. And even though I take your point about previous up and down cycles, did they not look at October 29th, 1929 as unique?
Well, again, you have to remember a couple of things about the nature of the stock market at that time. Virtually no Americans owned stock, either directly or indirectly, in 1929. Our best estimate is about 2.5% of the public held stock, either directly in their own name or in some kind of a retirement plan, although there were very few retirement plans. So most economists and economic historians keep insisting on the point, and I take the point, that the stock market crash, I think you said in your top of the hour that it unleashed the depression that followed. That's probably as good a way as any to describe it, but nobody's been able to say directly that the stock market crash caused the depression.
Right.
There were so many other weaknesses and vulnerabilities in the economic system, especially the financial sector as a whole, that's what all came crashing down as 1930-31 evolved.
I see.
So historians debate to this day, when can we mark the date when the crisis really becomes the singularity that we know as the Great Depression? My candidate would be the end of 1931, when Britain went off the gold standard and then the whole international house of cards came fluttering down. But 1930 was a time of great uncertainty and, frankly, just ignorance about what the nature and the velocity and the scale of the crisis was.
What was driving that ignorance? I mean, you talked about Herbert Hoover going back to that old toolbox, but this time around it didn't work. Why?
Well, for example, it became increasingly obvious that the people were going unemployed. And there were bills introduced in the Congress as early as 1930 to grope towards some federal assistance for the unemployed. All of those bills failed. None of them succeeded in being passed. Why? Well, for all kinds of reasons, but not least of all, because nobody could answer the question, how many people are we talking about? Are we talking about 500,000 unemployed or 5 million unemployed or 2 million unemployed? Nobody knew. Turned out the answer was 13 million by the time you get to 1932. Nobody could imagine unemployment on that scale in 1930. But the underlying fact that I'm trying to emphasize here is that there was no government or private or whatever kind of agency that was tasked with the job of keeping track of such things. So nobody knew. It was a very ill-informed picture of just what was happening around the country.
So fortunately for us, that's one of the great lessons that the nation did learn, because right now it's a totally different world. We have a real-time picture about virtually real-time picture about unemployment and the kinds of economic stresses that people are undergoing.
Yeah, to overuse a word that gets trotted out a lot these days, we have a lot better data. And we've had it for a long time, actually, when it comes to things like gross domestic product, GDP, or unemployment or employment, wage levels, and so on and so forth. That's one big lesson from the Depression era, is that it's incumbent on governments in particular to gather reliable data of that sort. So yeah, we as you say, in real time, we now have a much clearer picture of what we're facing.
Yeah. Well, Jack, we've got about a minute, 30 seconds or so to go before we have to take our first break. But your response to David Kennedy is reminding us about the amount of uncertainty that there was in 1930 that may have contributed to decisions that prolonged the suffering of the Great Depression.
Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to have you with us, David. I think the comparison I'd make is not to our economic situation today, about which we have, you know, ample documentation and so on. It's the pandemic. We don't know about that. In that regard, we are like the people in 1930. Is this going to come back in another wave? We don't know. Will it be around for years? We don't know. I think we're just as facing just that kind of uncertainty that people then faced about the economy.
Well, we are talking about the lessons that the year 1930, the first big year after the 1929 stock market crash, what lessons that year might have for us as we plow ahead in 2020 and look to 2021. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again. So long, sad times, so long, bad times. We are rid of you at last. Howdy, gay times, cloudy, gray times. You are now a thing of the past.
Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again. All together, shout it now. There's no one who can doubt it now. So let's tell the world about it now. Happy days are here again.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are looking back at the year 1930, the first year after the big stock market crash of October 29th, 1929, the first year of what would become later known as the Great Depression. And we're doing that because we want to know what lessons we can draw from that year in terms of the year that we all collectively now have ahead of us, after the major economic downturn that has been triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic. And I'm joined today by Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Kennedy. He's also professor of history emeritus at Stanford University. In 2000, as I mentioned, he received the Pulitzer Prize for his book Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 to 1945. Jack Beattie, On Point News analyst, is also with us as well. David Kennedy, we'll come back to talking about sort of the policy tools and the political climate of the year 1930 and the impact those had. But I wonder if you might actually just take a moment to put us in the lives of real people in that year. What were Americans experiencing in their homes, in their rapidly dwindling workplaces?
Well, let's remember a couple of data points about that that moment in time. Median household income, as of the census of 1930, which records essentially what people were living, the way people were living in the 1920s, was about $1,200 a year. Which, you know, in terms of our current monetary values, that seems like pocket change, I suppose, to a lot of people. But that was the situation. Secondly, there's a big difference in the demography of the workforce between then and now. At that time, virtually no married women worked for wages. Fewer than 10% of women who were married were out there in the marketplace of wages working for income. Today, the typical American household has, or at least did have until a few months ago, two workers in it, two wage earners. So when we talk about 25% unemployment, which is where we got to in 1932, we're, for all practical purposes, we're talking about 23 or 4% of all households went without income because there was not a second wage earner to absorb the shock. Today, we're approaching something on the order, I believe, of 15, 16, 17% unemployment, maybe headed toward 20. That's bad enough. It's god-awful. Let's be clear about that. But it's not the same. It doesn't translate as easily into every single one of those households going without income.
The only caveat I would add there, Professor Kennedy, is many of those households can only get by with two incomes coming in. So the economic pressures perhaps in that sense are analogous. Losing one income right now in this day and age may have at least a measurable similar impact as losing both incomes in 1930, maybe.
Well, maybe. I don't disagree with that. Yeah. And you're absolutely right that most people in this country live paycheck to paycheck, and losing one paycheck is going to hurt a lot, that's for sure. But it's not quite as abject, completely hopeless situation as that, let's call it 23% of households found themselves in by 1932. For example, I'll give you the example of my own parents. My parents were married in 1930, in the year we're talking about. And within about, I'm not quite sure, I can't reconstruct the history with exactitude, but within about a year, My father went unemployed. He was working in a very remote mining camp in the North Cascade Mountains of Washington State. The mining company went bankrupt, belly up. My mother was not working for wages. And to the best of my ability to reconstruct, my father did not get another paycheck for at least 4 years. There were no unemployment programs. There was no government assistance. There was nothing. And the whole household just absolutely fell flat on its back. And that was typical of all millions of people in the Great Depression era. So among the other lessons we've taken from that period is that it is incumbent upon government to react quickly and at scale in the face of a crisis such as we're facing now. We saw that demonstrated in the Great Recession, so-called 2008-2009, especially on the part of people like Ben Bernanke at the Fed and Hank Paulson at Treasury and President Bush, outgoing administration, took some pretty dramatic measures to counterpunch to that recession. And we're seeing it again now on the part of a Republican administration and a divided Congress. Nonetheless, several trillion dollars being appropriated to offset the damage from the current crisis. So we do learn from history, I believe, and we've learned that in the face of something like this, you need to act swiftly and at a massive scale. In 1930, our year that we're still discussing, there was so much not only uncertainty about exactly what was going on, but ideological uncertainty about what was appropriate and what was legitimate. And there was argument about whether government had any role to play at all. So that paralyzed everything. It took a political revolution called the New Deal to really change the schedule of political values in our society so that the responsibility of government to do something became mooted. And we've lived in that era ever since.
So this takes us beyond 1930 a little bit, but I have to ask, one of the things that I understand about the New Deal is that it wasn't just one large completed package, right? It was a consistency of trials and failures, efforts to find ways to assist the American people. In other words, there was work constantly being done to see how government could best get the country back on its feet. Right now, your point taken, Professor Kennedy, that we have learned the lessons of 1930, for example, that there was a massive injection immediately, within 2 weeks, right, of government aid. We saw a couple months ago, or a month ago at least. But we're also at the same time starting to hear quarrels on Capitol Hill about maybe that's enough. Right. I'm thinking about Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell being worried about deficits or saying that he doesn't want to necessarily, quote, assist states and their budgets. So there's already this discussion of like, well, at what point in time should government intervention stop? So can you take us back to 1930, 31 into the political conversations that were happening then?
Sure. Let me just say briefly, however, about the current situation, that the debate we're now witnessing is about the scale and the extent of this government initiative, not whether the government should do anything at all.
Right.
So it's a different, the debate has a different flavor. But again, let's go back to the 1930s. Two things to be said. First of all, the New Deal, when it finally comes online, 1933, never does succeed in fully vanquishing the Depression. Unemployment when Franklin Roosevelt took office was, we think, 25% of the workforce. It never went below 14% for the rest of the decade and averaged 17% through two New Deal terms. So even in the Roosevelt administration, there was some degree of confusion about what might work. There was some hesitancy about being too bold in the fiscal direction. And it took World War II, finally, to bring about to get rid of unemployment, revive the economy. So that's number one. Number two, and here I'm reminded of a famous dictum by Rahm Emanuel as the Obama administration was coming in about how you never want a crisis to go to waste. We're told that the Chinese character for the word crisis is a melding of the characters for danger and opportunity. And the way I see the New Deal, at least, is that it seized on the opportunity part of that that equation. And the lasting consequences of the New Deal were not a victory over the Great Depression. That simply didn't happen. The Roosevelt administration took a big bite out of unemployment, to be sure, got it down to 14% in 1936, but that's still very, very high. But the New Deal put in place a whole lattice work of institutions like Social Security, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Housing Authority, the Wagner National Labor Relations Act, banking reforms, and so on, that reshaped the American political, economic, and social landscape for generations thereafter and made the whole society less risky, more secure. And it was on that lattice work that post-war World War II prosperity was built. So the real importance of the New Deal for us, I think, is not exactly its short-term economic impact, but its long-term institutional rearrangement of the American landscape.
Right. Well, David Kennedy and Jack Beatty, just hang in here for one moment because we're getting some response online to this conversation. And Dori Scheimer, On Point producer, is here to share what some listeners are saying. Hi, Dori.
Hi. We're hearing a lot from people who are blaming greed and capitalism in both the 1930s and today for kind of the extreme pain that some Americans are feeling in this situation. So we got a lot of comments on that. But we got a question from Allison on Facebook saying, what are the differences between the economy before the Great Depression and the economy now? Was our economy right before this pandemic more stable or built on a more solid foundation than that of the late 1920s?
Yeah. David Kennedy, how would you respond?
Well, again, first of all, you remind me, Herbert Hoover, of all people, once said, he said, the trouble with capitalism is capitalists. They're too damn greedy. So even the much maligned Herbert Hoover shared that that sentiment that your correspondent did. Well, look, the economy of the 1920s on the eve of the Great Depression was, first of all, a place of tremendous vitality. The Roaring Twenties description of that decade is not without some historical validity. But it was also a time of great inequality, of very precarious living for many, many people. We think that in the decade of the 1920s, the so-called Roaring Twenties, that unemployment averaged about 9% per year. Now, that didn't mean that people went unemployed like my father did for 4 years at a time, but there was seasonal and annual unemployment at a fairly routine rate of around 9% a year, which is, if you think about it, extraordinary. If we had chronic 9% rolling unemployment in a modern economy before a pandemic, we'd think that was a political problem or a social and economic problem that needed to be addressed. So uncertainty, the inability of people to really plan on their economic and social and family's future, that was just sort of a fact of life in the 1920s. There's a classic study done of the, of Muncie, Indiana, fictional middle town, done by Robert and Helen Merrill Lind in the mid-1920s. And they tried to do a really in-depth analysis of what life was like in all kinds of dimensions in this community that they studied, religious life, family life, economic life, and so on. And in the course of their research, they struggled with how to come up with an explanation for a division they could see and witness amongst the people of Middletown between what they eventually ended up calling the working class and the business class. So they were recognizing class division in that society, and they thought this was typical of American society as a whole. But how did they define that difference? Well, it wasn't just in terms of income or wealth. It was in terms of security of employment. And the people that they put in the so-called business class were people who had jobs where they were more or less insulated from that rolling 9% unemployment rate through the 1920s. People, therefore, who could plan on the future, could save money toward their children's education, could plan on taking summer vacations, plan on some kind of secure retirement, and so on. People in the so-called working class had none of those advantages. Mm. And that was most people. And they just led lives of extreme precariousness, measured by 21st century standards, in any case. So when the New Deal comes along, what it principally does is imparts a greater measure of security and predictability and risk reduction into the lives of millions of people who could now have some degree of protection against unemployment, thanks to the great legislation of 1935, who could anticipate at least some minimal income in retirement, thanks to Social Security, and so on and so forth. So it's risk reduction and securitization of life, making life more predictable. That's for millions of people. That's the great legacy of the New Deal.
Well, Jack, let me bring you back in here because, of course, in the subsequent decades thereafter, particularly, I would say, in the last 30 to 40 decades from the present moment, we've seen that a risk amplification once again. And that's one of the reasons why many people point to the similarities in terms of fragility or precariousness, as David Kennedy said, income inequality between the 1920s and the 2000s and 2010s as well. Don't you think, Jack?
Yes. What FDR called the hazards and vicissitudes of life are more commonplace the lower you go on the class scale. And I have noticed, and I'm sure others have, that there's been an emergence of a new phrase in America, new in recent years. We used to talk about working people or the striving middle class. In recent years, I have heard the phrase working class more than I have heard in a long, long time. And I think that points to something, and it points to this, what we were talking about at the beginning, the structural weaknesses of a low wage economy, effectively for most people, the structural weaknesses of a politics and an economy of inequality, that when there's a crisis, when something happens, the people who suffer most are the people who were doing least anyway. They're vulnerable. They're the American precariat, you could say. And in that regard, I think our prosperity perhaps has been as haunted as the prosperity of the 1920s. Sure, we don't go all the way down to, you know, penury. There's a safety net. But again, we have to compare ourselves against our expectations. I don't think Americans expected, most Americans, the life they have had the past generation. I think they hoped for more. I think they were encouraged to hope for more. And I think that blight on the American dream is something that that perhaps we share with the people of the Depression generation.
Well, we are talking this hour about what the year 1930 might teach us about what's ahead in 2020 into 2021. You just heard Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst, and David Kennedy is also with us. He's the Pulitzer Prize winning historian. We've got a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Have you ever been down? I know you know just how I feel. If you ever been down, you know just how I feel. Well, I feel just like a darn soldier out across the battlefield. Baby, I'm going out west and don't want to leave you behind. I'm going out west, and I don't want to leave you behind. Because I'm afraid that when I return, baby, I'm afraid that you won't be mine. Ah, sure, you know what I'm talking about.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are looking back this hour to 1930 and what lessons that year might have for the remainder of 2020. And yes, 1930, the first year of what later became known as the Great Depression. Here is an archival newsreel from the era.
Little man, what now? Well, you can always sell surplus apples, 5 cents apiece, on the street corner. And if you're bewildered, panicky at what's happening to you and your country, you aren't alone. One of America's biggest industrialists has openly admitted, "I am afraid. Prosperity is just around the corner," say the hopeful headlines. But around the corners wind the lengthening bread lines, and a whole new class of citizens appears in American society. The new poor.
I'm joined today by David Kennedy. He's professor emeritus of history at Stanford University and author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book Freedom from Fear. Jack Beattie also joins us. He's On Point news analyst. And David and Jack, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about Herbert Hoover, because, of course, again, with the privilege that history allows us, we can see all of his missteps. But at the time, he was considered an extremely competent leader. Here he is a little later in 1932 during his acceptance speech for the Republican nomination for president.
I have but one desire, and that is to see my country again on the road to prosperity, which shall be more sane and lasting through the lessons of this experience, to see the principles and ideals of the American people perpetuated.
So, David Kennedy, talk to us a little bit about Herbert Hoover and how his experience and thinking contributed to the decisions made or not made in 1930.
Well, you know, it's lost to, you might say, popular memory because of Hoover's reputation as the presiding over the initial phase of the Depression, a failed presidency. No real argument about that. But it's lost to our popular memory, at least, that when he assumed office in 1929, he was widely regarded as arguably the most competent person in the world. He had an enormous reputation. John Maynard Keynes, who had watched him advise Woodrow Wilson at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, Keynes said that Hoover was the only person who emerged from the ordeal of the Paris peace negotiations with an enhanced reputation. As the presidential election of 1920 approached, Hoover was actively recruited by leaders in both parties, Republican as well as Democratic, to stand for the presidency. He had served in Woodrow Wilson's cabinet, progressive president. His first vote for president that he cast in the United States was for Theodore Roosevelt's Bull Moose Party in 1912. So he was a legatee of that progressive tradition, and he was widely regarded as an extraordinarily competent and effective person. If even somebody with those kinds of credentials and reputation could get walloped and overcome by something like the Great Depression, it's a reminder of just how complicated modern societies are and how even the best amongst us, the most intelligent and committed amongst us, can get overwhelmed by problems on a scale that no one had anticipated. So Hoover, I think, I'll repeat, Hoover's presidency was a failed presidency. There's no real argument about that whatsoever. But it wasn't because he was a malignant man. He was a child of his own times, as we all are. He just was inadequate to the situation that he faced.
So given that, David Kennedy, I think it's absolutely fascinating that we have some very prominent economists. And I'm thinking particularly right now, Ben Bernanke, who cut his academic teeth on studying the Great Depression, right? He actually says that the Depression is a bad metaphor to use in comparison to today. And he told the Brookings Institution last month, I believe, quote, if all goes well in a year or two, we should be in a substantially better position. That's coming from former Fed Chair Ben Bernanke. But given what you just said about Herbert Hoover, I'm still coming back over and over again in my mind to the force and importance of uncertainty, both then and now, right? And I would say right now, the uncertainties that we have are we don't know how much the coronavirus is going to change people's long-term behavior, especially in a consumption-based economy like ours, right? We don't know if banks are still going to feel cautious about lending to businesses big and small if they expect another outbreak or another major flare-up that's going to shut down the economy. There's just so much that we don't know. Can we at all have the kind of confidence that Bernanke seems to be tiptoeing into?
Excellent question. I think what Bernanke was referring to in that speech you referenced is the fact that the Great Depression lasted, depending on how you measure it, at least a decade. By some metrics, it lasted a dozen years, 1929 to 1941 in this country. Whereas worst case scenario, and it's a terrible worst case to be sure, this current pandemic crisis could last, let's say, 4 years until we get a vaccine. That would be awful, no question about it. But 4 years is surely a lot less than 10 or 12 years. So the duration of the Depression, I think, is one of its most prominent characteristics. One of the things that has stamped it in such large letters in the history books is the fact that it lasted throughout the entire decade of the 1930s. We're not likely to face that. That's number one. Number two, and I want to go back to something Jack Beatty said earlier, and I hesitate always to disagree with Jack, but I want to argue with you a little bit, Jack. Meghna, maybe you were making a similar point about the comparability of uncertainty today and 1930. I think that the nature of uncertainty today is actually somewhat different and lesser than it was in 1930. In 1930, people had difficulty even defining the problem. There was no adequate language to really sum up in a coherent way what the problem was and therefore what should be the vectors of approach to deal with it. Today, we know where the bullseye is. It's called the coronavirus. And we know what the pathway to getting out of this mess is. It's to find a way to knock down that particular infectious disease, and then we can begin to have a properly functioning society again. So, in general, I don't just further say that we understand, thanks to epidemiologists and others, how pandemics work. we know what their morphology is and what their developmental pattern is. So we have a pretty good toolkit, and we know where the target is. In 1930, the toolkit was pretty empty, and nobody had a really good definition of exactly what the problem was.
Jack, go ahead.
Well, that seems cogent to me. I would just then go, yes, we have the toolkit, David, but do we have the people to use the tools? You know, the political system of the 1930 threw up Herbert Hoover, the most competent man in the world, and Franklin Roosevelt, successful governor of New York, long career in the Navy Department and World War I, 50 years old, vital. Our system has come up with Donald Trump and Joe Biden, of whom a British observer recently said his public appearances range from the inarticulate to the incoherent. And politics, you have said elsewhere, David, that politics then was, was toxic, but now is septic. That is, the degree of polarization now between the parties is even more than it was then, when we think of, you know, FDR fighting with the Republicans. In fact, the Republicans, a lot of them voting for Social Security. Unimaginable. Well, perhaps not. Who knows? But anyway, I would just go to the quality of the people and the polity as well, and saying, yes, we know the problem, and I agree with you there. The future isn't that opaque. But the people that are going to be able to deal with the problem, has the political system turned out the best people to do that?
Well, let me remind you, Jack, that what I'm sure you know is that no less an authority at the time than Walter Lippmann, who was probably the single most widely read and respected pundit of the age, called Franklin Roosevelt during the 1932 campaign an amiable boy scout who, without any particular qualifications for the office, would very much like to be president of the United States. So even Franklin Roosevelt was rather conspicuously underestimated. So let's not sell Joe Biden short yet.
Well. So David Kennedy, far be it from me to intervene between two historians such as you and Jack, but let me offer this. When I said uncertainty, perhaps maybe what I should replace that with is complexity, because what we have now is a highly globalized world economy. We have a GDP in this country that's 70% based on consumption. We have a Fed whose toolkit is pretty empty at the moment. It seems that part of the United States' long-term recovery might require other nations to also recover rather rapidly as well. Some will, some won't. There are layers of complexity now which might be the big challenge that replaces the uncertainty. We have the data, but we don't know exactly what to do with it. So is that would you agree with that?
At the most general level, yes. And I think you're pointing to was probably the most uncertain dimension, or the place where it's most difficult to see what the future might hold. And that's the international context in which all of this will unfold. There's a great backlash now, and actually it antedates the pandemic, of course, in the Trump campaign in 2016 and Brexit in the UK. There's a great reaction against the globalization that has characterized international life in the last several decades. Whether the pandemic will deepen that anti-globalization impulse or wake people up to the benefits of globalization that have to be tempered, of course, by some better institutional arrangements, but we just don't know. But my personal opinion is that there is a danger, and I do think it's a danger, that there will be nationalist reactions to this. People will batten down the hatches and seal their borders to a degree that they haven't since many years ago. And the global standards of living will suffer, and global cultural exchanges will suffer, and we will be the poorer for it.
Was there some sort of trade reaction as well in the early 30s?
Oh, you bet. In fact, the notorious Hawley-Smoot tariff, the highest tariff in American history, was the version it took in this country, but it happened all over the world. The countries seeking refuge from these damaging winds of depression that were beginning to blow globally all of them essentially turned to mercantilist and inward-looking policies that are trying to insulate themselves from all this economic damage. And that suppressed world trade and global investment, capital flows, flow of goods, labor, everything, to an enormously low degree. And we think that's among the factors that account for both the depth and the duration of the depression that followed.
Interesting. So the last couple of minutes that we have, David and Jack, I'd like to help us fill up our own mental toolkits here. And David, if you had the ear of the president or the ear of any one of the governors in various state houses across this country, or leaders of industry and business, what lessons would you tell them to draw from 1930? Because now let's use the benefit of history to not repeat the same mistakes. What would you tell them?
Well, I would go back to a word that all three of us have used in the last hour, precariousness. I think that this crisis has surfaced just how precarious life is for so many people in our society. And this is an opportunity. There's the political will and a sufficient sense of community and being in this together that perhaps there's an opportunity here to reduce some of that precariousness going forward. And quite specifically and concretely, what I mean there is some kind of more realistic minimum wage standards, either state by state or even federally. And I think probably what the sector that is most the center of attention right now and that whose problems are familiar to all of us, I suppose, is the healthcare sector. And the fact that people go unemployed by the millions and thereby put at risk their medical insurance, medical coverage, thanks to our peculiar system of tying medical insurance to employment. That's another glaring problem, it seems to me, that needs to be addressed and that people are more aware of today than they were just as recently as a year ago. So I think those are two sectors. The dignity of a job that pays a minimum wage that is actually an effective wage for raising a family, let's say, or supporting oneself. Somehow rationalizing our healthcare delivery system so that it's not tied to employment and it is adequate to the kinds of health needs of the people.
Well, Jack, it sounds like David Kennedy is calling for a kind of innovation in governance in the 21st century context that we did begin to see after 1930 and 31 in the early part of the last century.
Yes, he's calling for reform. And that's a possibility of the moment. Another one, though, is a sort of crisis in governance and a turn away from democracy. After all, security is a primary need of life. And today, both lives and livelihoods are at risk. If a democratic system can't ameliorate that, will people turn to authoritarian solutions? We don't know. But it seems to me we're at a potentially democracy-breaking moment with this Hydra crisis.
David Kennedy, we have like 10 seconds left. Do you agree or disagree with Jack?
It's hard to say. I agree with the principle that maybe somewhere over the horizon there is that real danger of a turn to authoritarianism. On the other hand, I do think, given our history in this republic, we've proven resilient enough that that's probably a very low probability here.
Well, David Kennedy, Professor Emeritus and Pulitzer Prize winning historian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, always great to have you. Thank you, Jack, so very much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Ah, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember, they called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember, I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare